First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
This is WJCT News 89.9 in Jacksonville.
Opinions expressed on the Friday Media Roundtable are those of our panelists and do not necessarily reflect the views of WJCT News.
The mayoral transition process begins. Governor DeSantis's presidential campaign gets off to a rocky Twitter start, and Duval County Schools gets a new temporary superintendent. That's just some of the stories making headlines this week. Good morning, and live with you from Studio 2, I'm Dan Scanlon sitting in for Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect, so thanks for listening. And just ahead, all the top stories of the week on our Friday roundtable. Don't forget, give us a yell and question comment at 549-2937. Then later, the artist behind a new exhibition at Mocha Jacksonville. But first this hour, it's Friday, and here to round up all the week's news, we welcome Jacksonville City Council member Randy DeFore.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Claire Heddles from Jacksonville Today.
Good morning, Dan.
Regular contributor Charlie Griggs.
Good morning, Dan.
And Mike Mendenhall from the Jacksonville Daily Record.
Good morning, Dan. Good to see you.
And everybody is here live in studio, which I love to see. So listen live on your radio. Watch our video stream right now on Facebook or YouTube. And don't forget, give us a yell at 549-2937. Don't forget, 549-2937. So let's begin with our top story. I was hanging out with Mayor-elect Donna Deegan earlier this week when she met with the sheriff. And they spoke about the violence, increasing violence against officers. And that's when the sheriff said that politics are done. It's time to start working. And so obvious. And then he and Donna talked about the fact that they had met all day. And then the next day we see on the city's Twitter feed that Donna Deegan and her transition team met with the current mayor. And so let's talk about the press conference that was at City Hall yesterday when Mayor-elect Deegan introduced her transition team co-chairs, who she said came from across the political spectrum and represented, quote, a beautiful mosaic that we call Jacksonville to its greatest good. And I the one thing that got me is that she looked up. If you've never been in the City Hall atrium, it is pretty stunning with a skylight. She looked up and said, boy, isn't that beautiful? And all around her, city employees on all four levels looking down as she proceeded to talk. So, Mike, you were there. Mm-hmm. Let's start talking about the who. And then we can start talking about the what they are and mean.
Well, I think that, you know, when you look at the transition team co-chairs as she announced, I mean, she said they were bipartisan, and I feel like that's very accurate. She, one of the most notable individuals who actually wasn't at the press conference because of a planned vacation was former Mayor John Delaney. I mean, and I think that's, you know, a former Republican mayor, you know, responsible for the Better Jacksonville plan. I think that's, you know, bringing him in, I think, was really to show that, look, I'm making a serious effort to continue to reach across, you know, the party lines and to really represent the coalition that she had to create to become elected, you know, bringing over Republicans, winning those non-party affiliated voters. But then also, too, if you look at some of the others, we have Lakeisha Burton. A former assistant chief, and Nat Glover, former sheriff, you know, that really shows that, you know, that she understands that crime law enforcement is going to be important, and as well as to, you know, to make sure that they have that solid relationship with the police department, she's going to need to succeed. You also had, you know, people from the business community like David Miller from Brightway Insurance, as well as Darnell Smith, market president from Florida Blue, really showing that she's, you know, going to be reaching out to the business community. And then there was also, Kevin Gay, nonprofit CEO. So Operation New Hope. So, I mean, she really did make an effort to kind of cross all spectrums.
And, you know, Charlie, we've talking before the show that all of us in this room know many, if not all, of these transition team members and have very nice memories. I mean, I can remember Sheriff Glover. I can remember John Delaney as an assistant state attorney, mayor, state attorney, UNF president, always a conversational guy to talk to, always upfront with questions and answers. And then I covered the sheriff's race this year and got to know Lakeisha Burton pretty well, as I had already known her from her zone to Arlington. Assistant chiefdom. So you're another old timer like me. What do you think of the makeup? You've got some newer faces, and then you've got some really dyed in the wool, involved deeply in the city people.
I think if you pay attention to the dynamics of what we saw yesterday during the press conference, what jumped out to me was the fact that you had former Mayor John Delaney, who was a very popular mayor, and former Sheriff Nat Glover, who was a very popular sheriff, who both they served together. They both were serving together during their time in office. What that said to me was is that Donna Deegan is going to have some good advising counsel on how to address the community as a whole from a perspective of not only law enforcement, but how you govern the city. I think one of the things that people were concerned about was her, Donna Deegan's lack of experience in government. Well, if you got someone like John Delaney serving on your transition team, I'm certain that he'll be advising her on who are some of the key people who need to be in office. And of course, the dynamic of the business community as well. Most people know that Donnell Smith with Florida Blue has been responsible, especially Florida Blue has been responsible for a lot of public-private efforts to revitalize areas in our city. Lyft Jacks is one of the main ones. And David Miller is one of the people who've been very involved in the community. And of course, you know, you can't say enough about Lakeisha Burton, you know, who came off of running for sheriff to join this team. So there's a lot of knowledge there. And also, I think the key thing was that Deegan stuck to her three pillars of her campaign and was focused on, you know, how we're going to work to get these things done. And I think that as long as, you know, outside of the things that are coming up, that what she called them big rocks that are headed our way, but if she sticks to those three areas and she can show the public that she's laser focused on making sure those items are addressed, then I think that she'll be able to get off to a good start for her administration.
Well, we've actually got a Twitter comment from Joe, who says these guys were a stellar box of wisdom on Deegan's transition team, but that coalition doesn't have any Tea Party Confederate supporters who would wait to stifle progress and uphold Confederate monuments. Randy, you're on the council. You're in that building all the time. What are your thoughts about the makeup, and is there anything maybe lacking?
I really don't think there is anything lacking. I mean, you know, it really represented what she's talked about from day one, and that is unification of this city. A lot of the people standing up there are natives. They do not have any reason for personal gain. They literally love this city, and they do what they do because of their love. And, Darnell Smith, let's not forget, he was a former chair of the chamber. So that will really there are areas that that have been harmed in this election. One was the chamber, obviously, and the other one is the sheriff's office, right? I don't think the timing of TK Warder's recent news conference doesn't, you know, there was a reason for that, right? I mean, he was coming off having been the only candidate a sheriff who ever personally went against another candidate. It's one thing to stand up and say, hey, I'm for this person, but it's another thing to say, I'm against this candidate.
And Nat Glover did a spot that said, right, I don't support either, but stop yelling at each other.
So I don't think it's a coincidence that you got Nat Glover and you got Lakeisha Burton on that transition team, because there's a lot of healing that has to be done. And if you look across the board, all of that had to do with healing and with great wisdom. And to me, it felt like a warm hug. I mean, I was standing next to Anna Brochet, Garrett Dennis, Scott Wilson, people that had really stood up and taken a beating. And we all did a deep sigh of relief.
Yeah, I was able to cover Deegan's campaign party. And I'll tell you, from 7:05 when those first results came out to the time I left a little after 8 o'clock and I could still hear them cheering seven floors below, it was a warm and fun place to be. As a reporter, it's nice to be on a winning side. It's tough to be covering a side that loses. It was a nice way for me to ease myself into this administration. Claire, talking about transitions, obviously you cover a lot of school board, and these days they're still in the midst of a transition. But talk about this transition.
Sure, we'll get to the school board in a moment, the superintendent race. Yeah, I mean, I think it does speak to what she campaigned on, which is that she's not presenting a radical agenda, and that she said throughout her campaign, she's drawing on Jacksonville's past. It speaks to her long history in Jacksonville, drawing on people that reached their pinnacle of their careers, that really, as Councilwoman DeFore was saying, that they, they're doing it for their love of the city. And I think drawing on people that she has pointed to as bright spots in Jacksonville's history as indicative of what the future of her administration will look like, sort of reaffirms what she campaigned on, which is taking out the cronyism, but not the radical agenda that I think she was accused of. And that maybe some people wish she were more further left. But I think, you know, bringing in these people really reaffirms what she stated, bringing across the aisle, you know, out of the love of Jacksonville.
And one thing, Dan, to remember about these transition teams is that they typically don't do a lot of, you know, on the ground work. What they do is provide vision for the work that's going, you know, happen ahead. And I think that we'll know more about Donna Deegan's administration when you see some of the subcommittees form and the type of work that they do there. That'll say a lot about, you know, the makeup of what the administration may look like, you know, who some of the key people and so forth.
Give us a yell, folks, 549-2937. We want to hear your voices. Yes.
I was just going to say to you, you know, because you have such institutional knowledge on this team, a lot of the people that are going to be qualified for the top spots at City Hall, whether it's the chief administrative officer, your chief public relations officer, a lot of the people on this team are going to know them personally, or maybe even have experience working with them before. I mean, and there's always the opportunity that, you know, that Mayor-elect Deegan could bring in people from outside of the city to fill some of these key roles. But I mean, just judging by her transition team, it really seems like she's trying to tap that local talent. And so you're gonna have a group of people that are gonna understand how these candidates would operate once they are at City Hall, which I think is important.
My intriguing thought is Donna Deegan did stick to a lot of the topics of the needs of the city, and she spoke yesterday at the conference of hiring more police officers, that is necessary. But I think the nuts and bolts out there, too, are infrastructure. This is an old city, and every day we drive over potholes. Every day we're driving past, like the water main break last week that totally fouled up Mandarin for 3 days. I'm waiting to see the infrastructure needs get addressed as a significant portion, because that's the bread and butter of city residents. Speaking of politics, let's talk now about Governor Ron DeSantis, who officially kicked off his presidential campaign on Twitter Spaces on Wednesday night. But as I'm sure you all know by now, it did not go as planned. There was a 20-minute issue. You could hear people talking about the servers going down. The only thing that actually worked was a rather beautifully produced opening video as he adjusted his shirt and tie and then walked out onto stage. And, of course, after speaking, Donald Trump, President Biden, all had comments about what had happened. So let's open up the floor to what actually we should be talking about. Not that technology messed up, but that we have yet another Republican candidate, one who, along with Trump, is probably going to be the two fighting it head-to-head for that nomination. Who wants to go first?
I'll go first. I want to know whether it's DeSantis or DeSantis. I mean, that was my biggest... Not to mention that he starts off with his back to, you know, the video. His back is to the people.
He says DeSantis.
I was also surprised to hear that. I thought it was DeSantis. And in his campaign video, he said, I'm Governor Ron DeSantis.
DeSantis.
And I thought, have I been saying this wrong? On air?
So, mispronunciation and twit fit aside... And I'm being told now by our producer that it is DeSantis. So I guess we'll have to correct our pronunciation.
I guess so.
But Councilwoman?
Well, I think, you know, this has not been a surprise. I mean, look at what's been going on at the State House and Senate. I mean, all the legislation that's been passed has been showing that he was running for president. It's going to be interesting. I don't know whether his message is going to resonate with the rest of the country. It'll be interesting to see.
Yeah. Well, I've attended the last two news conferences he held in Jacksonville, and the two ago when he was asked that question, he sort of smiled and said, stay tuned. And then the last one he did at Miller Electric, he basically said, I'll have an announcement in a week or two. And he's right on spot on the money. It was a week or two after that Miller Electric announcement. Charlie?
But they've been planning this for a long time, obviously. This has been in the works, you know, for years. Ever since he got reelected to governor of Florida, we've known that this date was going to come. Unfortunately for him, though, you know, many people are criticizing the launch because not only did the launch go awry, but the content of the information that he was providing does not really sit well with the general population of the country. you know, many of the issues that he championed here in Florida, far-right issues, are not where the country is right now. And so it's going to be difficult for him to, I don't know, you know, perhaps he will have a change of heart and try to swing back towards the middle a little bit, but it doesn't feel like that's what he's going to do. People are going to look at that record and see how radical Florida has become. Book banning, you know, restrictions on LGBTQ laws, CRT or whatever you want to call it. All of that's going to play a role in how people perceive him as, you know, across the country. And I think that most people across the country do not have an appetite for those restrictive policies.
But yet he's not the only one, or Florida is not the only state that's doing this. Just listening to NPR this morning, and there were at least two stories regarding abortion bans, LGBT and trans. There's a large population nationwide that probably agrees with everything he's doing.
Well, we're seeing that those laws being passed in states where they have, they've been, you know, gerrymandered in order for them to get those laws passed. But the temperature of the country is not there. Much like what we saw here in Jacksonville just a couple of weeks ago for the mayor's race. You know, we saw one candidate campaign as far to the right as he could possibly go, and it didn't work out well for him. And many people believe that by the time we get to November of next year, who knows, because we got, you know, Donald Trump in there somewhere, right? Who knows how this is going to play out? But at the same time, you know, we know that across the country, the temperature isn't there for this type of politics.
Randy?
Yeah, I agree completely with you. If you look at the polling as to, let's just use abortion, for instance, the public does not agree with this legislation all across the South. Right. So, and they're fighting to make sure that it doesn't get on the ballot, because they know if it gets on the ballot, the people will vote it down.
Right.
So how can you have these, I don't know how these politicians think they can go against the will of the people. I mean, it's just, it's mind-boggling to me as politician that's on her way out. I don't understand that at all.
Yeah, but we appreciate having that voice, your voice, here on these Fridays. So thank you for that. And now, Mike.
Yeah. So I thought that DeSantis's choice to announce on Twitter. I mean, it kind of aligns with what we're seeing with a lot of Republican leadership here in Florida, for some reason, courting Elon Musk, the owner of Twitter. It seems to be a trend. But I do kind of question the choice when, you know, when we do expand to a national, you know, footprint. You know, I've probably frequently said on the show, I'm originally from Iowa. I've covered several Iowa caucuses, which is, which is where the DeSantis will be going first to take his message to voters. It's the first in the nation caucus state. And politics in Iowa are very different when it comes to campaigning. You are talking true retail politics. Iowa voters take their responsibility very, very seriously when it comes to vetting these presidential candidates. And they expect these candidates to get into rooms with them of 6, 7, 20 people. It doesn't matter how high on the political totem pole you are. And they will ask you tough questions, and they expect genuine answers. And that comes from both sides of the political aisle. I've seen during the 2012 caucuses, for example, I saw former Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum sit in a gym in Newton, Iowa, with 6 people. And then he was very good at engaging those people. And by the end of that, by the night before the caucus, which he won, he was in a pizza ranch with about 300 people, with international members of the media there, you know, high political donors, and just rallying the crowd. And I mean, and that's the kind of politics that you're going to see. And I think, you know, we've seen that, it's been documented, Governor DeSantis's struggles with, you know, kind of getting on that personal level with voters. So it's going to be interesting to see how he does that. And one other thing, too, that, you know, Iowa is one of those states that actually has passed similar laws. I mean, some of the agenda at the Florida legislature and the Iowa legislature this session has been very similar when we're talking about, you know, LGBTQ issues or, transgender issues. But it has not necessarily played well, like, with the voters there. It's been very polarizing with the vote with the electorate in that state. So I think that, you know, if DeSantis comes in there with that woke kind of quote unquote woke, anti-woke agenda that he has been pushing, I'm curious to see if voters are going to respond to that.
You know, I spent in my early career a number of years in New Hampshire, and I can never forget that we had a gubernatorial candidate actually speak to reporters in the middle of a state park out on a picnic table. You have a very traditional, rock solid core of people there. And then you have the art community and the radicals. And I don't know if they're going to accept. Some may, some may not accept what DeSantis has to present. But they're a totally different crop of voters than anywhere else that I've ever worked. And Florida's intriguing. We do have a call here from Brittany in Putnam County. So, Brittany, sorry for holding. But, Brittany, what's your comment?
Hi. I just wanted to say, I think I was going to push back a little bit on the idea that there's not a whole lot of people out here that care about what DeSantis is doing. I'm a mom of two. I commute an hour into Jacksonville for work, but I do live in Putnam County. But it's like my husband and I both work full time. I own a business. So it's hard to get out and protest and I think make your voice known. And I think there are a lot of people and a lot of moderate people that don't like what DeSantis is doing, but there's not really a platform other than maybe the internet. And that's kind of just like an echo in the dark. It's not really getting out to anybody, but I think there are a lot of people that are extremely worried, myself included, about where DeSantis is taking us and where he could be going with, you know, as a presidential runner, like a front runner. I don't think he is going to stand against Trump very well. I don't like either one of them. I think he's bad for Florida, and he's just turned this state into something I don't recognize anymore. I was born and raised here, and I'm worried, and I just want to get my voice out there. There's a lot of people that are worried, and but we have nowhere to kind of express that that concern. But thank you so much for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Brittany. Well, Claire, you and I and Charlie and Mike, we're out there on the street. We're talking. What do you think? Or what do you think we're going to start hearing on the street as journalists about the choices for president?
Well, I definitely think there's going to be a lot more national media attention on Florida, talking to people like Brittany about, you know, what DeSantis has meant in Florida over the past years that he's been our governor. Because part of his campaign pitch is this idea of Make America Florida, pointing to what he's done in Florida. And so voices like Brittany's, like that caller, who, you know, or have experience of living in Florida under DeSantis, those are the voices that I think national media are going to be looking to in the coming months as this campaign moves forward.
You know, I've been here for 40 years. I've covered everybody from Walken Lawton Childs through Governor Graham, who did work days all the time and literally let the reporters hang out with him. Martinez once told him his button of his shirt was undone. That's how conversational we got. It's a different atmosphere now as a journalist to work versus governors who, as you were talking about, Mike, were one-on-one with any reporter. You could come up, you could talk, you could whatever. And they were out in the community and working with the regular folks, or at least hanging out with them. We know that Bob Graham's work days were probably not so much a work day, but it got him right down to digging a ditch or working and hanging out with the people. And that's the difference. These days, there's so many layers between us and even the governor himself. DeSantis has stopped doing a reporter gaggle afterward. He's on the podium. You can't go beyond a point, and you got to yell the question across wherever you are. So it's a different world. I understand the logistics, the safety issues of putting a government figure in an audience and hoping that nothing happens. But I do miss the ability to walk up to a Bob Graham or a Martinez and just ask a question. So any thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's a huge disconnect. Yeah. I mean, that's why we're seeing what we're seeing, right? I mean, the polling is showing that these politicians are putting in place legislation that the people do not want, whether it's the permit issue with guns, whether it's abortion issue, whether you name it. I mean, there is a huge disconnect, and I think the caller was right on. I think she represents the majority of the people, and that's why I think the end result's going to be someone like a Tim Scott. Tim, don't rule out Tim Scott. Let me tell you what, I think he has a real chance.
And he seems to be very down to earth in what I've seen in media coverage. We've got a comment here from Charletta. His back to the audience, meeting Governor DeSantis, was not a good look, in my opinion, but based on all of the anti-everything and hateful bills his majority legislature has allowed, that backside view was totally appropriate. Okie dokie. Don't forget, give us a yell. We'd love to hear what you have to say. 549-2937. We got about a minute, maybe 30 seconds left. Just any closing thoughts about where DeSantis goes from here?
Well, I just think that you know, many people in Florida, like Brittany's comment, many people in Florida don't really get the breadth, you know, the understanding how deep it is when about some of these policies until they meet them on their front door. And what we're seeing from a business community standpoint, we're seeing how the E-Verify system bill now has started to impact, corporations who use, immigrant workers, right? And because many people are afraid to, you know, come out, or they're afraid of the system, they don't understand what they need to do. And it's having an impact on, especially in South Florida, where, people are working on these construction sites. So until this sort of meets you on your front door, people don't really understand, you know, how they are connected to what happens in Tallahassee for those 60 days.
We're going to switch topics again now. And in a week of transitions, there's yet one more transition happening. We learned that the Duval County School Board will promote Deputy Superintendent Dana Krisnar to temporarily fill in for the departing superintendent while it searches for a permanent successor to Dr. Diana Green. And our own Claire Heddles has been deep in the middle of that. So, Claire, you were there. What happened this week?
I think some people might think it would be a natural fit for the deputy superintendent to step up, but it was not without debate in the last 2 weeks. There was two special meetings, one this week, one last week. And during last week's meeting, there was even the proposal of having three short-term superintendents before they find a permanent one, one for this month of June, because they need a superintendent in order to have their school board meeting June 6th, one that would sort of be the transition superintendent, and then one long-term superintendent. It seems like at this point, Dana Krisnar, her potential contract is up to 6 months unless the board decides to bring in another short term, or, you know, when they hire their eventual permanent. But there was significant debate about whether it should be someone in-house to take over during this transition period. And particularly school board members Charlotte Joyce and April Carney said that we should bring someone from outside the school district to come in, and I think maybe the words they used was clean up, or the general sentiment was to clean up the administration, particularly regarding the Douglas Anderson reporting teacher misconduct. And they called back to this grand jury report about Duval schools failing to report potential student crimes, which some on the school board said they have thoroughly addressed. They have changed school police. That is not so much an issue. The teacher misconduct, I think everyone recognizes as something that needs to be addressed. But there has been debate about how much does this current school administration need an overhaul immediately, and how much do we need, you know, a leader who will smooth the transition, who understands the district, who can lead us through the summer and the start of school while the board looks for what they want for the future.
Well, you know,
and in the end, it was the smoother choice that I think won out the current.
As one of the old guys here in the room, on one hand, we've had current or just retired school officials, Duval County school officials, become the temporary superintendent. So there's some continuity. On the other hand, it's been discussed that if you're part of the current administration, which is having some concerns, maybe pulling someone from outside the room is a smarter deal. But obviously, needs must, as the Brits would say, school is ending, but they're already talking about August and school starting and changes, and there's some state laws coming in. So obviously you need someone there. Councilwoman.
You know, I actually was in a meeting yesterday with Charlotte Joyce and asked her about exactly what went down. And her concerns, Claire, was exactly what you mentioned, was that how can you expect someone within the current administration to fix the issues that they've had? She believes there are intrinsic issues continuing in terms of reporting, especially crimes. And I get that. I understand that. But I do think if it's a short-term person, if you bring someone from the outside, it's going to take them 6 months to figure out where the restroom is. You know, I mean, so to have somebody in for the short period of time to bring in someone new is, I believe, is the right answer.
And she was a chief of staff, which intrinsically in her number of years here, that does allow her some knowledge of how to work with staff and get ready. Charlie.
Yeah, the interim superintendent can be directed by the board to do what it needs to be done. You want that continuity. You want some consistency during the transition period. What you don't want is for someone to come in and start doing things anew and then hire someone 6 months later, and then they come and undo all of the things that the interim just put in place. So the safe bet is to, you know, bring someone in like Dana Krisnar, who's been there for a while. She knows what she's doing. You know, she knows where all of the, as they say, the bodies are buried. And she can take direction from the board and do what they need her to do in the short run while they manage the search for a new superintendent. I'll tell you, though, one of the things that's going to challenge the school board is the search for a new superintendent. You know, given the political climate here in Florida and some of the policies that are going to have to be enforced during that person's new administration, it is going to be difficult to find someone unless they're, sort of a political, they're leaning in a political way. The board is supposed to recognize that and hire someone who's best for the job. But typically these superintendents are apolitical, and that's how they address their jobs. But this is different here in Florida.
Brings me to you, Mike. You're the business writer here, and the school board is in essence a business. Do you want to work for a business that's been in the news as much as this one has for some of the reasons? Or would you say no if someone called and said, would you be interested?
Well, I definitely think that's going to be, top of mind to any candidate who takes the job. And Charles was headed exactly where I was thinking, as far as the climate is concerned. I'm also curious, and maybe Claire can answer this. How is the school board pursuing the hire? Typically in a situation like this, especially when you have one of the largest school districts in the country, they would hire a national search firm who really has expertise. Is that the direction that they're going?
At least according to the school board chair, Kelly Coker, that's what she's presented as what I think what she wants to do is bring in an outside consulting firm. And she said that she's talked to outside consulting firms about what that process would look like. So to hire this firm and have them manage the search, which I think is what she wants. I'm not totally sure that's going to pass the board, probably. But I think that's the most likely scenario is that they bring in an outside firm because it is going to be a hard search. And there's lots of school districts in Florida looking for superintendents right now.
And that outside firm may also calm some of the fears of a superintendent coming in being more political and keeping just that administrative look and with a focus on education. So.
We've got a caller here. Let's go to Jason in San Marco. Jason, what's on your mind? Jason?
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I just think that, for one, DeSantis may not even win Florida. That's a definite question mark going forward because he has to defeat Trump here. But I think when the rest of the country learns more about what DeSantis has done and how he's behaved as governor, it's definitely going to take some of the luster off of his candidacy. The three things that immediately come to mind are, for one, he's basically had no pushback from the legislature here. So when he's violated a law, as in the transporting the migrants from the border up to Massachusetts, he simply had the legislature go in and change the law. He's made it impossible, or at least is trying to make it impossible, for the citizens of Florida to actually know where he is. And that's because he doesn't want them to know that he's not actually. And he's had, as I said, there's been no pushback. So when your political action committee is called Never Back Down, it doesn't sound like a person who I think is going to be ready or capable to actually govern with split government. Those are my comments, and I really appreciate you taking my call.
Thanks, Jason. Interesting point, journalists in this room. When do we get the schedule for the governor? We get the schedule for the governor at 6 o'clock at night after that day's schedule has occurred. I think that's rather interesting. It's like confirmation of where he's been versus where he's going to be. And we learn of events happening usually early the morning, and you have an hour to get ready and RSVP. Again, as journalists, I'm not griping. I'm just letting you know that's the way business is done. So any last thoughts?
Controlling the message.
Understood. Any last thoughts on our superintendent and where Duval County Schools is going from here?
I think there's still kind of this split among the school board about Dr. Green's tenure. I mean, there's people on the board that think she was forced out and that she did a great job. She has a good administration and they want to continue the work that she started. And then there's people on the school board that think that she committed serious errors that need to be corrected and those permeate throughout the administration. And so part of this superintendent search, I think, also is this conflict over how people feel about how Dr. Green was treated, especially in recent weeks surrounding the scandal at Douglas Anderson.
I'll be intrigued to see where she goes. Some of our past superintendents have gone on, and we've had a track record in this city of superintendents going not under their own steam. I'll be intrigued to see where she goes from here.
She's going to land on her feet, definitely.
I met her at a very nasty night when there was a murder at Raines High School. She had just started, and I got a good impression off her at that point. Have not had any news dealings with her at all since then, but I'll just be intrigued to see. Let's move on to our last interesting topic of the week. The good news is the Florida-Georgia football game will return to Jacksonville at least through 2025. But as we had heard during the mayoral debates, one of the big topics is going to be what happens to TIAA Bank Field as far as renovations. And then our dear mayor did state, and this was confirmed, that at some point the stadium will be unusable as it undergoes renovations. So what does that mean for the big college football moneymaker in this town? And already rumblings over the years that at some point or other, they might not want to travel to Jacksonville anymore to hold their rivalry. Maybe they'll go somewhere else. So I'll throw this ball out and see what happens.
Well, you know, as we've been talking about, Mayor-elect Deegan had been meeting with the current administration yesterday. One of the interesting points she made at the press conference when she was asked by a reporter was that there's too much new information right now about the stadium to discuss it in a press conference. It was kind of coy, alluding to the fact that there were a lot of new details. So, I mean, you can interpret that the way you will, but I would think that if Florida and Georgia took their two-year option, they would know that stadium would be available for at least those 2 years, which kind of suggests to me that possibly the renovation wouldn't start until after that. But I guess we'll just have to see. I mean, I'm curious to find out if the renovation plans are further along than what Mayor-elect Deegan originally thought, or if they are actually further behind, as far as planning goes. So I think that's definitely something that we're going to have to watch.
Having undergone at least 1.5 renovations there as a journalist, I'd be surprised if we did have anything within 2 years there, or anything that would per se really affect the playing surface. Look how long, Randy, it took to get what's happening along the riverfront done. And now it's all happening. I'm looking at foundations starting to go in. The old Times Union Center, that you can see the parking garage is up already for that condo. You can see the base of that. And then go up the river. The Jazz Festival's going to have to find another place next year. There's going to be something at all of those sites. So you tell me, Randy, are we looking at a new home? For Florida, Georgia,
See, this is my spider senses go off. I really hope that we're not as far along, because I'd rather this administration do the negotiation than the current. I mean, I'm talking the new one, the new administration versus the current. And you're right. I mean, we've had a ton of legislation that's been passed that relates to the downtown. You have to give it to Mayor Curry that there's been a lot of puzzle pieces that he's put together for the downtown area, whether it be Mosh and the hotel is going up as we speak, right? The Four Seasons. So I think you're going to see a lot happening in the next 18 months. Jacksonville always seems to miss the top of the market, right? I mean, I just don't know why we keep doing this. But when you see other cities like Tampa and St. Pete, and they take advantage of strong economies, and they see things go up very quickly, we miss it every time. I mean, think about they had to renegotiate the apartment complex where the old restaurant was on South Bank. You know, I keep shaking my head. I just hope that with interest rates going up that we don't lose other deals.
Yeah. I kind of think that, once a deal gets done or we know more about the new stadium, then that's going to inform the future of the Florida-Georgia game here. I can't imagine after all this, this facility with all of the bells and whistles, that it wouldn't be attractive for both schools to stay here and make that one of their prime targets for, how they showcase their schools. And as far as the new stadium is concerned, I always like to remind people that, this is the way we've seen it done in the past. It's really not an indication of how it could happen in the future. The stadium out in L.A. is 100% privately financed, right? And then you see the stadium in Nashville. It's a four-prong financing deal. $200 million of that money comes from the NFL. We've never heard anyone mention the NFL as a potential piece of that puzzle. So there are many ways that this can get done.
You mean the same NFL that in 2005 said they'd bring a Super Bowl back to Jacksonville?
Right, right. But and of course, everyone knows that the NFL is all about relationships. The owner the owner has great relationships within that, you know, that small organization of, you know, it's a monopoly, right? Then that's what drives, you know, how these deals are done. And what, you know, when one owner sees a stadium, the other one owner wants one. And we're last. We're the last one on the list now who hasn't had a renovated or brand new stadium. So I would imagine that we're going to see some kind of creative financing coming up, you know, a way to get a real deal done. The challenge is going to be, you know, what's going to happen, you know, where the Jaguars are going to play in the interim of that deal. And I would imagine also that those of us here locally that enjoy seeing the Jaguars play here in Jacksonville are going to want to do all we can to keep them from playing more games across the water, because you know, the NFL has said that that's a thing to them. You know, they want to test that market with one. They're testing it with one team, and that's us, right? So it'll be interesting to see how all that plays out, because I believe that scenario is part of the mix as well.
Mike, you're the business guy again. I'll throw the ball to you.
Well, when you're talking about the stadium renovation too, Randy had made a good point that, you know, missing the top of the market. Right now, interest rates are incredibly high, so construction costs are also very high. So, you know, giving that couple of years before you really start, you know, getting the stadium work done could actually possibly give the market some time to stabilize and maybe have interest rates eventually come down in a couple of years. So it would be a less costly project there. So I think that could definitely come into play when you're talking about the stadium renovations. You know, one of the things too, when they first started talking about renovating TIA Bank Field, Ron Salem, the current city council vice president, made a big point to say, you know, one of our goals is to get one of the college football playoff expansion games. Now, clearly, the NCAA has been moving forward with plans on where those are going to go. Maybe there's an opportunity in the future to shift locations for something like that. But you know, that's, you know, so those are the kind of things that, you know, as the stadium renovation is going to be happening, that they're going to have to consider. And and, you know, in Florida and Georgia, you know, the I think it was University of Georgia has been talking about, you know, been talking about considering, you know, going back to a model where they play, you know, 1 year in Georgia, 1 year in Gainesville. And so that's going to be, you know, I think a new stadium would be a big bargaining chip in that for the city to keep that game here.
Claire, any last thoughts before the lightning round?
Sure. I read this week when the news about the Florida-Georgia game came out that it has been in Jacksonville since 1933. Mm-hmm. That's 90 years of history. So I don't think any mayor wants it on their watch that they're going to lose the game
right
from Jacksonville. And the only time that it wasn't played here was 94 and 95 when there were renovations to the stadium. So it seems like there's long enough history that the city wants to keep them here.
All right. And finally, it is time for our lightning round. All right. I'm going to throw this one out. For me, Memorial Day weekend, don't forget our fallen soldiers on Monday. But don't forget the USS Orlick just reopened for business and tours. So let's go see a piece of history this weekend while we're thinking of our soldiers. Anybody else?
Well, I'll just jump on that. In my district, we have the Memorial Day concert at Memorial Park. So come on out. It's at 6:30. I hope I see everyone there.
Mike?
Yeah, so at the Jacksonville Daily Record, we've been following a story over the last couple of weeks. There's a $464.4 million project that's being proposed downtown called Gateway Jacks. Mixed-use apartments, restaurants, that kind of thing. And but that one of the people that's involved with that project it worked on the $3 billion Water Street Tampa project in Tampa, Florida. So there's, you know, outside development interest coming in, and there could possibly be a deal going before the Downtown Investment Authority this summer. So it's something we're watching.
Claire?
There was great reporting this week in Jacksonville Tributary about a man, Dexter Berry, who died in jail last November after not receiving heart medications. Excellent reporting. They're continuing to follow that. That's from the Tributary. And I'll also point to Will Brown from our own Jacksonville Today. Had a great profile of Dr. Green this week, too.
And Charlie?
Yeah, well, I'll wrap up with a Jacksonville Jaguars story. You know, they traded Riley Patterson, the field goal kicker who kicked the 36-yard field goal to win the game against the Los Angeles Chargers. And they brought in the Denver Broncos kicker. His name is Brandon McManus. And so many people are kind of confused about that because McManus's made field goal percentage is lower than Patterson's. So it's kind of got things a little uproar in the Jaguar world.
Okay, that's our lightning round. That's our media roundtable. I'm going to thank all of you for being here because we've got to move on and talk about art. So thank you, everyone. Have a good Memorial Day. And don't forget, The Florida Roundup today at noon will take a closer look at the launch of DeSantis' presidential campaign and his platform. Our medical show on this week's What's Health Got to Do With It will examine dermatology and skins of color tomorrow at 4 and Sunday at 9. Thank you to our panel, and up next, a preview of Mocha Jacksonville's latest exhibition from the artist himself. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, Mary Tyler Moore was famous for her funny and plucky characters in the 60s and 70s on the Dick Van Dyke and the Mary Tyler Moore shows. She's now the subject of a new documentary on HBO. Also, we remember novelist, essayist, and critic Martin Amis, who died last week. Join us
today at 1 on WJCT News 89.9.
No sign of a debt ceiling deal. House Speaker McCarthy tells the markets there's nothing to fear. And how not to launch a run for the White House.
Are you there? Can you hear us?
I'm here.
You can always rely on the Friday News Roundup as the space to wrap up the week's biggest headlines. That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
And welcome back. We're going to talk about a new exhibition by American realist painter Beau Bartlett called Beau Bartlett, Earthly Matters. It's opening at Mocha Jacksonville this weekend. Bartlett is here to my right, and Amber Sesnick from Mocha is here on the left. If you're watching on our feed with a preview. Beau, let me say, first of all, I'm going, okay, art, realistic. I take a look, and I'm looking at your exhibition from a previous museum and some of the paintings that are coming. You've got a family in a rowboat with a church steeple floating in the water. You've got a man on such a hyper-realistic bicycle, I can see the paint shining on the fenders. I'll ask you about what these women are wearing on their heads that are pointed. And your comment here in this on this website, the purpose of art is to wake us up to our own situations, to our neighbors' plights, to our own calling, to our own lives, to the world around us. Beau Bartlett, welcome to the studio, too. Just give me a 30-second bio. Obviously, you know what you're doing, but how did you get to know what you're doing?
Thanks, Dan. Happy to be here. Well, I grew up in Georgia, Columbus, Georgia, and I was there until I was 18. Then I went to Florence, Italy to study, and studied with Ben Long, an American realist who was studying with Pietro Annigoni, the great Italian fresco painter. And after that, I moved to Philadelphia, lived in Philadelphia for 30 years. Went to the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Art. That's the oldest art school in the country. And started showing there and eventually started showing in New York.
Obviously, going to Firenze, Florence, that's even older art school. I was there as a college kid, and I remember just being blown away by the artwork and to realize this artwork is older than anything in this country. But your artwork brings in that American touch. I mean, we're used to the murals and the tapestries and things of Europe. Hyper-realistic, but that's the country scene. That's a group of well-known or young men, recognizable young men on a beach. Almost photographic, and that's what amazes me. So how did you start out to be that hyper-realistic and that almost black and white snapshot?
Yeah, Dan, that's a great question. Because really, when I was coming along, almost all art was abstract expressionism. So I got out of high school in 1974, and I just assumed I'd be an abstract painter. And I had read My Name is Asher Left by Chaim Potok, which is a fabulous book about a young Hasidic Jewish boy that wants to make art but is confronted by his culture and not encouraged to make graven images. So he studies in Florence. He goes to Florence to study. So that's what I did. And once I was there and ensconced in the Renaissance, I had that as my foundation, and it really casts a long shadow. So even as I moved to Philadelphia and was studying Thomas Aikens and the great American realist painters, I spent a lot of time with Andrew Wyeth out in Chatsford, Pennsylvania.
Oh, now that's amazing.
Andy and I were best friends until he passed away. So we were, I'd really known his work when I was young and wanted to study with him. And that was one of the reasons I moved to Philadelphia. But it was years before I got to meet him and I made a film on him called Snow Hill, and spent 5 years every day with he and his wife, Betsy. And then after that, we were just best friends. And I'd learned to draw in Florence with Ben Long. And I learned to paint at the Pennsylvania Academy and with Nelson Shanks, the great American portrait painter. But it wasn't really until I spent time with Andrew Wyeth that I really learned why to paint and what to paint. And it's really just about painting your life in the end, when you really want to just a version of illustrating your own life, because we're all original. We all have our own stories to tell. And it's, I've learned my techniques and the ways that I want to tell it, but then what to tell really came from Andy, who really just painted his own life.
Well, Amber, I've looked at some of these paintings, and I'm very well aware of the layout of Mocha. So tell me, when does this start, and where are his paintings?
So his paintings are on the third floor at Mocha, so they take up that entire level of galleries. And the exhibition opens this evening. We have our opening celebration and preview event tonight with a member hour from 8 to 9 p.m. Or I'm sorry, a community hour from 8 to 9 p.m. So we invite anyone out in the community to come join us tonight. It's a rainy night, so it's a great time to be inside at Mocha.
Now, Bo, let me ask you the question. Do you take a photo of your characters before you do them? Do you imagine them? They are so... They're literally like a 1950s photographer, news photographer, going out and catching a moment in time as an image. And so I'm intrigued. How do you get this? And then we'll talk about the church and the water later.
Thanks, Dan. It's interesting that you ask. Well, because when I was coming along, I really liked the art of Norman Rockwell. So because my family didn't know much about art. You know, we were a little small town in Georgia. And unless it came into the house in a magazine of some sort, like Saturday Evening Post mm-hmm. or Life or Time or Look, I wasn't familiar with it. So I was familiar with Andrew Wyeth, I was familiar with Norman Rockwell, and maybe Picasso. So really it was about the art that I was most interested in as a child was the thing that informed me. And that was how Rockwell took photos. He really was photo-based. So there were several books at the time that showed his process. And mm-hmm. But I am not a photorealist. I'm sort of more of a naturalist, I think, where I do a lot of drawings. The ideas will come to me either in dreams or something I'll see in real life, do a little thumbnail sketch. And it can take years for the ideas to develop. I'll keep a sketchbook and keep rehashing it and thinking, what does this mean? And why should I paint this? Does this help the world at large if I were to paint this? And so because it's all about thinking about it holistically, in terms of what you choose to do. And so I'll eventually get models to pose. And then once it's sort of like getting pregnant with an idea, once you finally are ready to bring it to term, you just work straight through on it. And I do all the drawings, all the studies, all the color preparations, color studies, and then I'll take some photos near the end, sort of just to give me a reference point. And I do use black and white photography as opposed to color photography, because it sort of gives me the tonal relationships and the big idea. And then the color sort of secondary.
Okay, real quickly, how long does this gallery show his works?
So the exhibition closes September 10th. Visitors will have the opportunity to see it during our regular hours, during our evening hours on the first and third Wednesday of every month, and during our free Saturdays, our Vistar free Saturdays every week.
Okay, well, I'll have to ask you off mic about some of those paintings, but I want to thank Bo Bartlett for being here. MoCA, a brand new exhibition coming tonight, and then obviously this Memorial Day weekend and beyond to go see it.
I look forward to seeing people there tonight.
I might actually do it myself. Great. I'm Dan Scanlon in for Melissa Ross. Dave Luckin is our executive producer. Senior producer, Heather Schatz. Director, Isabella Da Silva, with technical help from Morning Edition host, Michelle Corum. Our theme music was composed and performed by Club Des Belugas. Have questions or comments about First Coast Connect? Send an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Again, Dan Scanlon here, sitting in for Melissa Ross. You're listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. We'll all be off on Monday for Memorial Day and back on Tuesday, so have a good weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.